Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin.
And I guess today, Ken, we are marking on this date the beginning of the Scott Brown era.
I cannot contain myself. It is very, very exciting. Everybody screams 41, 41. I thought there was a new revival for George H.W. Bush.
Right, right. The return of 41.
They don't mean
only
that
this
Bush.
Time. Yeah, so, only this time the Republicans are excited about it because this is the new senator from Massachusetts who is giving them 41 votes in the Senate and enabling them to back the Democrats down and take away their, quote, filibuster-proof majority.
Yeah, but this is so silly.
This is completely silly. I think we've said consistently since last summer that the worst thing that could happen to the Democrats would be to get, well, at least that it would not fulfill their dreams, that it would be a mirage to have 60 votes.
There was a great headline right after the Scott Brown victory, given all the hand-wringing in Washington among the Democrats. Oh, we only have 59. The headline in the Village Voice says, Scott Brown wins Massachusetts Senate seat, GOP takes majority, 41 to 59.
Don't you think this might be confusing one or two people out in the country who think that 59 is still a couple votes more than 41?
It's 30 years since any party had that many seats. The Democrats had 58 or 60, perhaps, as late as 1978, and that was the last time. But look, the Bush Republicans had 53, 54 votes, and they passed a lot of things for better and for worse.
And why did they do that, Ken? How did they do that? How did they manage with a mere 53 or 54
Well,
votes?
They also won over many Democrats.
That's
not happening now.
That's not happening now. So the point is, in the Senate, you need more than a simple majority. You need to be able to bring bills to the floor, and that means you have to be able to guarantee a filibuster won't succeed. And that means, according to the Senate rules since the mid-1970s, you need 60 votes to hold off a filibuster.
Before you go any further, remind us what it was like before they moved it to 60 votes.
That was 67 votes. And yet, in 1964, a coalition of the two parties, again, was able to band together, get 67 votes, and pass the Civil Rights Act over the objection of Southern Democratic senators who had, for half a century, been filibustering any such legislation. It took a lot of doing, but they got together a bipartisan coalition of 67 votes. Then in the mid-1970s, they said, let's lower that threshold. That 67 is too high. Let's bring it down to just 60. But, you know, it was their decision. They decided to lower it to 60. And then they said, if you want to stop a filibuster, you got to get 60 votes together. And they thought that would make it easier to stop filibusters. And they thought that would mean that the Senate would come a little bit closer to majority rule. But what's happened?
Even when there would be a filibuster, a filibuster would be when a senator stands up and holds the floor. He or she would have to just talk forever.
Right, like Strom Thurmond in the 50s.
Like Jimmy Stewart in the movie. Mrs. Smith Goes to Washington. But in other words, it would be a real filibuster. Now, the threat of a filibuster is what ties the Senate in knots.
The Senate has agreed, essentially, not to force anybody to stand up there for hour and after hour. It's undignified. It holds up the schedule. It gives too much attention, if you will, to the point of view of the filibusterer. And so the majority party for many years has been unwilling to really enforce the nature of a filibuster and ask the people who want to slow down or stop a particular bill, whether it's a civil rights bill or a tax bill or what have you, ask them to actually hold the floor.
Well, one of the reasons the majority party does not want to force the minority into doing that is because one day the majority party could be the minority party, and then they'd be in the position of having to do that, and then they want to lose the power either. So really, you know, you think that why don't the Democrats fix this thing? Because everything is being bottled up and the Obama administration can't get passed. But, you know, during the Bush administration, too, a lot of nominations were stopped by Democratic threats of filibuster. And so they didn't get the 60 votes for Bush nominees as well.
One of the central things that I think gets lost here is that the House of Representatives, with the same percentage of Democrats that the Senate has, almost down to the exact number, the same percentage of Democrats, has passed virtually everything the Obama administration has wanted them to do. Financial re-regulation, they went after the climate bill, they passed the health care bill, all in 2009. And all those things essentially have hit a wall in the United States Senate because of these rules and because the individual senators don't want to be required to actually go out there and filibuster for real. And they have worked a system within the Senate so that they don't force themselves to do that. It's all for their own individual convenience and empowerment.
So if the Democrats only see what they want to see and the Republicans only see what they want to see, and President Obama is obviously frustrated in his inability to get some things accomplished, perhaps that explains why he would go visit the House Republicans at their retreat last week and perhaps try to get some kind of an understanding between the two sides.
Yes, and it was an interesting dialogue.
Fascinating.
It made a lot of people who like to watch the question period in the British Commons ask why we can't have something like that here.
But wait, can I interrupt for a second? Because, you know, if the British had won the Revolutionary War, we'd all be speaking English today.
Well, many of us might.
Yeah, okay.
But there are other issues. And among those other issues, of course, the separation of powers, the fact that the British have a parliamentary system where the executive power, the prime minister, emerges out of the majority in the parliament. We don't have that here, even though we have a president who happens to have been in the Senate. He certainly was not nominated
for six
by
months.
The Senate. Yeah. He was not nominated by the Senate. And I think we saw the slight chill in the room when he met this week with Senate Democrats, much the way he met with the House Republicans. It was less contentious, but it was not really a sense of, you know, guy who made good from our home group here, the Senate Democrats, coming back as a honored alumnus. It didn't have that air. And that was at a place called the Newseum, a fairly recent institution here in Washington that has some meeting rooms, and they all got together there. And interestingly, even though they were in, if you will, the palace of the media, the president had this advice for the Senate Democrats.
If everybody here turned off your CNN, your Fox, your, you know, just turn off the TV, MSNBC, blogs, and just go talk to folks out there instead of being in this echo chamber where the topic is constantly politics.
Did he tell people to stop listening to the podcast?
No, he didn't say that, but he did say that there's a lot of too much loud stuff coming out ad nauseum, huh? Ad nauseum, huh? Very good. I saved that for this one.
Oxygen. Oxygen.
Yeah. Anyway, when the president and the Senate Democrats spoke, I don't think it had the spontaneity that you saw with Obama and the House Republicans. And the reason I say that is because it seemed like every Senate Democrat who got up to ask a question, coincidentally, was somebody in trouble in 2010. It was Michael Bennett. It was Evan Bayh. It was
Barbara
Blanche
Boxer.
Lincoln. Well, not Barbara Boxer, but
Barbara Boxer is not safe.
Sure she is.
Kirsten Gillibrand is not safe. No, they are not safe.
Name the Republican. Well, you mean because of Scott Brown.
Because of Scott Brown. They are endangered because the voters have turned on them. The anger that they expressed against Republicans in 2006 and 2008 is wheeling around 180 and being directed at the Democrats who were elected in those two elections. In the end, Barbara Boxer will have a struggle, not against the Republican, not against Tom Campbell or Carly Fiorina, but against this voter anger. That's her problem. That was Martha Coakley's problem in Massachusetts. And while we are calling this, jokingly, the Scott Brown era, and there are people out there declaring the end of the Obama presidency, what's really going on here is you've got 10% unemployment that's not coming down. You've got a lot of angry people. You've got activism on the right, no activism on the left. And you have institutions in Washington, particularly the United States Senate, that simply are not small-d democratic and functional. They are dysfunctional and they are anti-democratic.
Before you write off the Democrats' chances completely in 2010, and of course the Democrats are running scared, and we see that everywhere, either incumbents are not running or realizing they have to raise a ton of money very quickly to show signs of life. But don't forget that the Republicans have their own problems with internecine primaries and ideological battles, as we've seen in Florida, as we've seen in California, as we've seen perhaps even in Illinois, even though Mark Kirk won the nomination this week.
And that's a good nomination. That is probably the smartest nomination the Republicans could make in Illinois. And he is ahead in the first polls that have been done with him up against the Democratic nominee, Alex Janulis.
Well, actually, two things. First of all, Mark Kirk in Democratic-leaning Illinois, and now once upon a time it was a Republican state.
Not that long ago.
But since the Republican scandals gave us Rod Blagojevich, perhaps Rod Blagojevich gives us Republican renewal, and Mark Kirk seems to be the kind of Republican who could win statewide. At the same time, given the fact that Alexei Janulis is...
Look, he's 33 years old.
Right.
He made his money by being a Janulius.
Right, his family's bank. His family's bank.
Millions of dollars in dividends from a community bank, not Goldman Sachs, but a bank called Broadway Bank, which has been involved in mortgages and which is in shaky financial condition, and yet he has reaped considerable dividends from his family's ownership of that
so
bank.
If this specter of Rod Blagojevich is hanging over the Democratic Party, why in God's name did the Democrats seem to rally behind Janulius? Now, of course, there was a guy named David Hoffman in the primary who was never run before, who was a good government kind of guy. He was a former inspector general in Chicago who was supposed to have no electoral sway in the primary at all, came within 5 points of beating Janulius.
He had no money and he had no name recognition. He still came within 5 points. There was also a third candidate, Sheryl Jackson,
former NPR.
Former NPR employee. And yet Janulius had such a head start because he was the establishment candidate and he had the money. There was probably no way he was going to be headed in a primary that took place when? The first Tuesday in February. Is that when people are thinking about nominating people for a November election?
But they've been
February?
But they've been thinking
10 months before?
But they should have been thinking about it ever since last summer when one Roland Burris decided that he wasn't going to run again, of course, because he raised $1.75.
Okay, but this is Illinois politics. Why do they put the primary in February?
Well, it's always been an early primary. Matter of fact, they moved it up early to give Barack Obama a boost in 2008.
Right, but it's the earlier advantage, than ever, right, because they are trying to push away the participation of larger groups.
And the advantage that the Democrats vis-a-vis Obama got in 2008 by moving it up early could be to the detriment of the Democrats in 2010 because they had the early primary.
I absolutely believe that's right. And I think in September and June and other times when they're much more natural for primaries, people are going to look around, scratch their heads and say, why do we already have these candidates? Why is it that we had these guys from way back last winter before anybody was focused?
Before we get rid of Illinois completely, we still don't have results in the governor's races in both primaries. For the Democratic side, Pat Quinn, the governor who took over when Blagojevich got kicked out, he was supposed to have a sizable lead over Dan Hines, the state controller, and yet it's like an 8,000-vote difference. Out of 900,000 votes cast, Quinn has claimed victory. Obama has congratulated him. Most Democrats seem to be rallying behind Quinn, but Hines said, wait a second, there's still absentee ballots out there. And so you think, wow, the Republicans could take advantage of this Democrat indecision, and yet the Republicans don't have a nominee.
Well, and let's face it, one of the slipperiest positions to be in American politics lately has been the governorship of Illinois. Mm. It's not exactly a springboard to higher office, although sometimes it can put you in a place where the federal government will buy your meals for the next several
years.
And
you can make license plates, as George Ryan learned.
Down in Florida, we're getting a new congressman, and it looks?
It looks like that on the same day that the voters were voting in Illinois. Florida 19, the district around Broward County, Palm Beach County, that Robert Wexler resigned to head up this Mideast think tank. Ted Deutsch, a state senator, with the backing of Wexler, with some campaign appearances by Bill Clinton, easily won the Democratic primary. There is an April 13th general election. We should learn from, as Senator Coakley will tell us, that we should not write off opposition chances, but it looks like that Ted Deutsch will be the next congressman from that district.
Yes, there does not appear to be a Scott Brown brewing there. Some more news around the country, and we've hit on a couple, three states. Let's not go by Arkansas this week without noting that a major opponent has developed from Blanche Lincoln.
It looks like that Congressman John Boozman from the northwest part of Arkansas, which is always a solidly
we always
Republican.
Think John Paul Hammerschmidt.
Oh, God.
We think of the northwest part.
That's my favorite
Arkansas
song. His name is like my name, too. Yeah. Anyway, John Boozman will announce on Saturday morning that he will run against Blanche Lincoln. Already some polls show him with a double-digit lead over Blanche Lincoln. It seems like that's another seat, if we're going to add Illinois to the list, as we've added North Dakota and Delaware. It looks like that Arkansas could now be a Republican pickup.
Yeah. So we are already looking at four Democratic seats in a lot of trouble, including the seat that was the vice president's and the president's, those
right.
two seats. And then we've got the other two you just mentioned. And, you know, out in Nevada, although the Republicans haven't really brought out their strongest candidate yet in Nevada to run against Harry Reid, this is a guy who is probably in as much trouble back in his home state as he is here in Washington trying to run this enormous but enormously troubled Democratic majority in the Senate.
Yes,
Harry Reid.
And of course, it's always a trouble for a Democratic leader in Washington to balance liberal interest with a conservative rural interest back home. The good news for Reid is that while he's consistently, and we talk about this every week, while he's consistently losing to a generic Republican, there are no generic Republicans.
Why don't they nominate generic Republican.
He would be great.
This is the year.
For a generic Republican.
You know, and it's interesting you should bring up that point, Ken, because right at the moment, the least popular political party in the United States is the Republican Party, followed very closely by the almost equally unpopular Democratic Party.
And leading in the polls is?
Is a group, another party that is not a party.
Right.
That is not in any way, shape, or form a party and promises and vows not to become a party. The Tea Party.
The Tea Party is not a party.
Well, it isn't literally a party. The party they're referring to, of course, is the Boston Tea Party, the anti-tax demonstration in Boston back in Revolutionary days.
Before there was a podcast.
Before there was a Democratic Party. And the tea in here is also a pun because it stands for taxed enough already. It's an anti-tax, anti-government movement. And as we're recording this podcast, they are beginning to record registrations at their first quote, convention in Nashville, Tennessee at Opryland.
Quote, Nashville, Tennessee.
At quote, Opryland, and they are going to hear from, quote, Sarah Palin.
Well, but here's what's so fascinating about this is that there was a Tea Party and there was a Tea Party. In other words, there was a small T, small P for Tea Party around the country, people who helped elect Scott Brown, who are rallying against rhinos on the Republican Party.
Rallying against Barack Obama.
Rallying against Barack Obama
rallying
around the
rallying against government.
Exactly. Whereas this convention is one faction of a Tea Party that, yes, will have Sarah Palin speaking there this weekend on Saturday, but a lot of Tea Party groups are boycotting it either or just not showing up. So
and in some cases, canceling after having committed to go.
So we've seen divisions this year in the Democratic Party. We saw them in Illinois. We'll probably see them in May in Pennsylvania with the Specter seat. We've seen divisions in the Republican Party, the Rubio-Crist thing, for example. And we've talked about that forever. But there are divisions in the Tea Party movement as well.
And when we say popularity, what we're talking about here is polling that asks, do you have a more favorable or less favorable or more negative impression of this group, and I believe the Tea Party is running somewhere around 40% positive. The Democrats somewhere around 30, and the Republicans somewhere around 20.
Where's the podcast, by the way?
The podcast is somewhere south of a recognizable. But the point being that the more you know about what people stand for, or who their candidates are, or what they represent, the less likely you are to actually feel good about them or to approve of them. But the Tea Party has a positive identification, partly because it doesn't have any people in office, it doesn't have anybody who is a responsible figure, and it represents anger and frustration.
And if there's anything that the Tea Party folks have in common, it's distrust with government, with the way things work.
And big business.
And big business.
Major corporations.
Such as Toyota.
And maybe the Department of Transportation, too. When Toyota got in trouble this week because of sticky accelerators and troubled brakes, the Secretary of Transportation, Ray LaHood, was there with some advice for drivers.
My advice is, if anybody owns one of these vehicles, stop driving it, take it to the Toyota dealer, because they believe they have the fix for it.
And then there was a slight backtracking.
Yes. He had to walk that one back.
And you know that Ray LaHood is in trouble because the president expressed extreme confidence in his abilities.
Confidence in his abilities. Well, hey, here's a theory, and I'm not saying that anybody in the Tea Party movement started this, and I'm not saying where this necessarily came from.
Uh-oh.
But there are people who wonder if the way that the federal government is going after Toyota for this and the way that there is such an extraordinary feeding frenzy over the troubles of Toyota in some sense reflects the stake that the federal government has taken in a couple of other rival car companies, Ford and GM.
So as this theory goes, the everything from the cash to clunkers program,
remember that?
Which also helped Toyota. And so now the president is coming back, trying to be even-handed, because we're in an era of bipartisanship. So when he protected Toyota during the cash for clunkers, now they're ganging up on Toyota to protect the American car makers.
You know, when you express it like that, it seems irresistible. And we can conspiracize with the best of them, but that's it for this week's political podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Reardon.
Join us again next week for It's All Politics from NPR.
Nashville cats play clean as country water. Nashville cats play wild as mountains.